Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Kate Wolfenden. Kate is co-founder of Project X Global, a WWF-backed corporate accelerator that enables entire industries to make difficult transitions in their sustainability agenda together. Kate's a first-class graduate turned serial creative entrepreneur, having set up and run four creative businesses before she was 27. She's now spent the last 8 years creating partnerships and innovating for the sustainability sector for Oxfam, Climate Care, ChildReach International, CDP, and now WWF. I spoke to Kate online from her office in London. So Kate, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's going to be a fun interview, this one. I can feel it in my bones.
No pressure.
No pressure. I should explain to listeners that Kate and I's conversations normally take place over a glass of wine or two.
So or two, yes. Yeah.
Or two, yeah. So, and we're famous for putting the world to rights one way or another. So let's get started, shall we? Kate, you've, as far as I can tell, you've spent your entire career so far 100% in on change, on sustainability, on having impact one way or another, with different hats on, different guises. When do you first remember this being important to you?
Great question. So actually, and that's really funny that you see it that way, because it wasn't like that at all.
Really?
Yeah. So I moved into the sector in 2008, actually. And before then, I used to work for myself. I used to run a couple of live music bars. We had like a fashion and arts boutique. It was a shop with a stage. So it was like a gig venue, but also a shop. We had a little basement gallery, did festivals, street festivals. But yeah, so that was, gosh. And I did that up until 2008, when I sort of had a moment. Realizing that you can make a lot of money for yourself and you can keep yourself very busy and you can have a lot of fun, but it doesn't necessarily give you that sense of fulfillment.
And you felt that lacking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, it's quite late in comparison to you. I mean, it's scary now. You see these kids and they're already at 3 and 4 years old and they've already got some little identity and they're already wanting to make a massive, massive difference in their own little world. And I started when I was, what does that make me? 28. I've always had,
That makes me feel old.
But yeah, no, hopefully my heart's always been in the right place. But actually taking action has started when I was 28, and I crossed over into the sector via Oxfam, actually. And I worked on their Oxjam event, because I used to throw festivals. And so
that was your routine.
Yeah.
Because that's what you had in your bag already.
Exactly. And it's crazy. I wanted to move into the sector and I thought, oh, well, I've run businesses. I'm an entrepreneur in inverted commas. That makes you, that makes you sellable to the sector. And then they just were like, you don't fit in the box, Kate. We can't have you. You don't fit in the box. But yeah, so I came in that way. And that's my first touch with climate change. And climate change has been my heart and soul since, because every problem in this world, this is just my view. I'm sure loads of people have it differently. But without tackling the overarching problem of climate change, every other problem will ultimately end in the same way. And so climate change is a fundamental for me. And it's
when did that Road to Damascus moment take place for you?
I think it was during working at Oxfam on this Oxjam event and learning, actually. I felt like I was quite sheltered, really, in terms of my understanding of quite the environmental urgency that we live in. And then through the Oxjam events and the engagement, the campaign message that year was around climate change, and it was shocking and it was embarrassing that I didn't know, and it struck me right to my heart. And the more and more you uncover, the more and more urgency you see, and the more and more lack of understanding or lack of willingness to understand at the time. Obviously, we've moved a long way since there. We're in a brilliant space of momentum now for climate change. But at the time, it was frightening. There was nothing I could do apart from dedicate my life to it, to be honest.
Why do you think it is that, going back, 10 years or so, at that time, there was mounting scientific evidence. It was pretty irrefutable. There was very little evidence to the contrary. the overwhelming body of scientific evidence. There was the Stern report, I think, had probably just come out, so that had shone a very big spotlight on it. And yet neither the political will nor public interest in the agenda really was, the needle didn't really move, not to the point of it becoming intentional. Actually, we're going to do something about this now.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? What is it about human nature that we just look the other way? We just stick our head in the sand?
Well, I think that's, you just hit the nail on the head, haven't you? I think that I saw it as two separate things. So one from a more political standpoint and one from a human standpoint. And from the human standpoint, I think people never really give too much of a damn on a really public perspective until it happens on their doorstep. And then when it happens on their doorstep, that's when they start paying notice. And I remember the first major funds for the adaptation in New York was launched after all the subways were flooded. Mm. That's the first time you heard major funding with adaptation. So I see it from that angle, that it started to hit people on their doorsteps. We live in an ever more global world now. And thanks to media, albeit saturation of media, we see it now and we get it. And we probably know people who have experienced it, and that's bringing it ever closer to our doorstep. So the Stern report was a great sort of mark in the sand. But for me, it was a siloed report. And I think that's what I really liked about the IPCC, and what everyone really likes about the IPCC process that we went through, albeit the COP process took 20 odd years to get. And it isn't necessarily at the standard that we need it to be yet. But what the IPCC process and those reports they created multi-stakeholder consensus around the world. You can't create irrefutable evidence. Someone will always refute it. But they near as damn it got it by convening all of the scientists and getting consultations globally, so that when that fifth IPCC report came out, you really can't deny it. It gave people the consensus, the momentum and direction to push global negotiations forward. Mm.
But at that time, so you were 28, you felt this very personally. You felt very, you didn't use the word, but it felt emotional. You really responded to it in a powerful way when the scales dropped and you uncovered this information, which wasn't new information, it was just first time for you. What was it about you, do you think, looking back, that be it in your nature or in your experience or kind of upbringing, that resulted in that kind of response? Because that isn't the response of most people.
I think it's something innate. So if I find something that doesn't work, then I'm terribly impatient about wanting to fix it. And I was remembering being at home, and so I was raised in small businesses, which was another big influence for me, and seeing my dad take on sort of a money pit of a corner pub and then turn it into a restaurant, and then a bed and breakfast, and then a hotel, and then take on another one. And he said that from a very, very young age, I used to work for him, and we'd have had the busiest session in the world, and everyone would be going crazy, and at the end, everyone would be shattered, and then I'd wait for the last person to walk out the door, and I'd be like, right then, okay, so what we need to do next is blah, 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 blah. because that was wrong and we could have done this and what about that and blah, blah, blah. So I think I'm a compulsive problem fixer is probably the best way to describe it.
So there are problems and there are a whole mother of problems. So exactly. At 28, without any political platform or business platform or any other platform, you decided you're going to make climate change your mission. Can't fault you for ambition there. But how, I mean, seriously, how do you channel that, you know, kind of, because that's, I mean, if you go back to stuff like Stephen Covey, you know, Good to Great, kind of Seven Habits of Effective People, you know, one thing that he says is that, you know, effective people don't spend too much time focusing on stuff that's outside their control. You know, they massively expand their sphere of interest, but it's well outside of their control or influence, and that just leads to kind of burnout and frustration. And where did you start? What was the baby step? What was the thing that got you going on this?
Well, I think it was, I don't think I set out, whereas my heart was, this is what I want to dedicate my life to. I don't know whether I set out to combat climate change as a one woman, I just knew I really wanted to contribute to it. And so I think the biggest part of it was actually just being able to, because the NGO sector is so, I think, resistant to big ideas. And I think, how did I approach it? Gosh, well, I needed to come into the sector one way, and the only way I knew after after doing that sort of volunteering with them, with Oxfam, was through sales, because I guess being an entrepreneur, you have to sell every day. So I sold and I sold and I sold, but I banged my head up against a brick wall for, gosh, maybe four years or 5 years, because people kept on asking me to sell things that I didn't believe in. I didn't think that they were pushing the boundaries of what is possible with charity or what should be happening with charity. And I felt this massive injustice that of the scale of the problems that are happening in the world in comparison to the scale of the ambition of the people within the organizations. And this just is it ignorance? No, because we're all trying to make impact in certain ways. But for me, I just couldn't take my head and my heart out of the macro level. I couldn't do the starfish principle of let's just help this one person here. It just didn't, it didn't seem worthwhile, or it didn't seem to be tackling the real problems that we needed to face. And so my journey is, it was a learning experience, really. So I worked Coalface, or close to Coalface, so a small international NGO, learned what the word volunteering was, realised that wasn't where my heart was, realised there was other ways to be able to create more impact. Then I went to CDP, where they were the precipice between business and NGOs, and how you can be much more strategic in your partnerships. And so went inside to learn more in there, and then left and went to WWF. But when I got to WWF, that was it. I'd almost started, I've had enough with this sector. I was pissing too many people off because I was asking too many uncomfortable questions and not being able to sell the thing I was being asked to sell because I didn't believe in it. And yeah, and then it was Last Chance Saloon for me. I was looking for jobs outside of the sector to see if there was another way to be able to do it. And then beautiful fortune and some helpers along the way nudged me in the right direction, and I ended up taking a job in innovation in the sector. And it was the first time in my career when I've worked for other people apart from myself where I was paid to be me. And that was the turning point for me, because yeah, I was paid to be annoying.
You said it.
Which I'm quite good at. But no, I was paid to change the system as opposed to perpetuate it. And that's what that's me. That's the core of me. So
about? I mean, the most head of innovation jobs in, sizable organizations, it's about innovation management. You know, it's about corralling everyone to be innovative rather than you being the person that does innovation.
Absolutely. Well, and this is the thing. So again, the journey in, and I wasn't the head of innovation there. There was a woman who I deeply love and respect, Claire Cotton, who was my manager, and she'd come over from Cancer Research UK. She was the first female boss, probably first boss actually, that totally, totally, totally believed in me and just totally cleared the path for anything I wanted to do. She was amazing. We were tasked to do exactly that: innovation management, incremental innovation. Let's create a couple new products that we can sell to sell to donors, and then maybe make another half a million a year per product or whatever it might be. That was in essence perpetuating the system. There's an element of disruption in there, but largely it's just perpetuating a dare I say it, broken system. But then over those 2 years, we were realizing quite how difficult it is to try and bring change into an organization that doesn't want to change, even on the smallest frame. And so through Claire's amazing skill at opening up this opportunity, she managed to get the organization to look more broadly at what she called at the time big hairy ass goals. And if we are going to create pain and we are going to create change in an organization, why do it for such a small amount? Why not do it for the things that really matter? Because with that mandate, that then I came into my own. This is my sort of dream brief, essentially, what I've spent banging my head against the brick wall for five years in the sector, and then got that beautiful mandate. And it's from there that it all came forth, and we were able to look at disruptive innovation and where the whole of Project X came from.
Looking back, I mean, the important role of air cover being provided by that kind of boss, time and again you see has been critical, just to give you the space you need at that time to be able to try something out. I just wonder where Claire's agency came from.
Yeah, so I think, I don't even know whether she had the license to do it, or whether she just had the determination or the grit to do it. It's quite a risk averse, and this is not unlike many organisations, but in places, especially in international NGOs, it can be quite risk averse environments. And so you can have an agency within an organisation, and that you can you have that political clout to be able to say back off, or you have just the cunning. And I think my first, so with Claire, she had cunning. And she just spotted when something was worthwhile, and she would just clear the path and just enabled me to do what I needed to get the right info, to be able to build the right proposition, which was amazing. And then later I was, we moved from being a sort of just a concept into an adopted program within WWF, we moved from being on the fundraising side of WWF to the programs to give it that credibility and that linked impact. And that was when I then was gifted a new boss, when Claire actually moved on at that time as well. And she had the political clout, and she taught me a lot about organisational politics. I would say full on ignorant about how organisational politics worked, and didn't even realise it, but I was walking myself into disasters, self-made disasters, because I didn't understand how to do it. And so I've had it.
For example.
Oh God. Well, there's just too many. I walked into a meeting with one of the senior people of, oh, no, I can't believe I'm sharing this on a podcast. One of the senior people who particularly, I think, was quite fond on women just sort of being quite quiet and doing what they're told, and especially someone younger and less senior. But I walked in with my big grand plan to point out all the things that have been done wrong and how things could be better, which was probably the worst. So I think at one point I was told to, I don't think you're going to be able to do it, but we'll give you the rope to hang yourself. Now get out of my sight. So I was like, okay, all right then, goodbye. And so, then I just buried myself under a rock and just kept on putting my head down and working so that I could prove the fact that I wasn't, that I could actually deliver on everything that we'd said. But yeah, it's quite funny. I've got too many though. I'm still learning. I'm on that learning curve.
You were lucky in some respect, aside from the air cover that you were getting from individual bosses, but the prevailing culture. I mean, you characterised it as risk averse at WWF, but I mean, it does have a long history of spin outs. You know, it's Marine Stewardship Council, Forest Stewardship Council, and you know, there's been hits and misses, but there's been sufficient number of hits for it to embolden the organisation to support more promising ventures, which could then spin out, become independent. So, I mean, had it not been for that, as well as sort of a background context, you might have got stuck.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, like I said, it's not like WWF is specifically risk averse. Most of the organisations that are large organisations in the sector are, so they're not particularly one way or the other. But we were very fortunate with WWF, and especially in the UK, in the office, because they had the precedent already of spinning out the brilliant. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but the Finance Innovation Lab. And so there's been multiples, but so there was a precedent, and there was a yellow brick road, as our as Nadia in our team.
Good way of putting it.
Yeah, a yellow brick road to follow. So yeah, it helped for sure.
So how did you get started with it?
Project X.
Yeah.
Okay. So
and you might like to explain, you know, top level elevator pitch to the listener what Project X is.
Oh.
Because it's a big idea.
Yeah. Yeah, a big but logical, systematic idea. But so Project X is a corporate systems accelerator. It helps entire industries rather to be able to make difficult transitions in their sustainability agenda together. Focuses on large corporations who find it difficult to be able to adopt small sustainable innovations into their value chain. And we help them with the costs and the risks associated with doing so. So it makes a sustainability decision a commercial decision, and so therefore accelerates progress. And that's sort of it in a nutshell, really.
You make it sound so easy. And of course it isn't. So how did you strike upon that as your theory of change to begin with?
Well, so it was a very analytical approach, which I've become ever more so over the years. But so we worked with Accenture, who I adore, by the way, Accenture Development Partnerships.
Yeah. Gib Bullock and...
Yes, yeah. Well, actually, Gib's moved on now, but generally everyone in the team is amazing. Their heart and soul are in it. I think it makes a world of difference. We work with Accenture to be able to map the micro and the macro trends to be able to impact the environment and environmental priorities over the next 10 to 15 years, and created a big chunky report in a very analytical format that would be easy and easily translatable to what was at the time a very INTJ or intensely analytical board. Me being an ENFP, it wasn't right that I should sell it in. So we got some appropriate people within Accenture to be able to...
Note to listeners, we are talking Myers-Briggs here now. Yeah. If anyone's wondering what an INTJ is, just look up Myers-Briggs.
Yes, yeah. INTJs, needless to say, INTJs and ENFPs are quite different characters.
Yes.
They need a translator.
They wouldn't voluntarily spend time together.
So we did that, and what that was really doing was sort of creating a desire or an awareness in the WWF leadership that there needs to be a change, that the world is moving, and we aren't moving with it, and the scale of the challenges are moving. And so that report was done, and then there was another one that looked at the world's biggest growth markets and overlaid it with WWF priorities to be able to identify some hotspot opportunity areas that WWF would have a right but also a responsibility to step into. And those were sold in as well, me not being there. That's a good lesson I've had as well. Sometimes you don't need to be the messenger, and sometimes you can be the problem if you're the messenger. I've learned that a lot, especially this year.
Depends on your audience, I guess, doesn't it? You know, and who that carry the message, who's got legitimacy, if you like, for the audience.
Indeed, yeah.
On whatever the message is, you know, if you're making a commercial argument, then get someone who's got commercial legitimacy.
Exactly that, yeah. And often I felt one of my big learnings this year is that either bring somebody with you or send somebody in your place, or what I find fascinating is bring someone with you and let them open the discussion, because by letting them open the discussion, it opens the hearts, the eyes and the ears of somebody with you who would otherwise keep them closed. And then you've got the space to be able to speak afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I've seen miracles happen in meetings on the basis of staging it in the right way and knowing when not to speak and when someone else should speak first. So these opportunity areas that came out, and one was scaling sustainable innovations, and the other one was, and these were prioritized by leadership, but scaling sustainable innovations, and the other one was sustainable finance. And the problem statement that underpinned scaling sustainable innovations was not that there's not enough innovation in the world, there's almost too much. It's just it's not scaling at the rate and the pace that we need it to. And similarly, on the space of this is sustainable finance, it's not that there's not enough money in the world. There's just not enough of a risk mitigated pipeline of investments to be able to invest in. And the right and responsibility for organisations like our own to play a role there is the quicker that we can get a pipeline of investments, the quicker we can scale these innovations, the quicker we can preserve and conserve the world's resources. And so then we went from that to an even more systematic approach of, oh, that's all well and good, but what assets and what right does WWF have to play in that space? Mm-hmm.
What capabilities have you got in doing that?
Exactly, yeah. And WWF, it's got boots on the ground, credibility, sustainability credibility, in, gosh, 70 plus countries or whatever it is. It's invested $1 billion into conservation projects around the world. But those are sort of quite high level. We actually asked all the leadership what they thought their core competency was, and they all said convening power. And then I asked all of the other leaders in other organisations outside of that, and I said, what do you think your core competency is? And they all said convening power. So it's not a USP anymore. And so I looked a level deeper, and WWF has been part and parcel of setting up the majority of the private sector coalitions around the world, the roundtables you mentioned earlier that span out, certification schemes. We have pretty much on speed dial, pretty much any major corporation that's responsible for consuming the world's resources. And that and the sustainability expertise and the brand salience around the world were the pieces we could bring to the table. And it was a matter after that of taking these opportunity areas and taking these assets and playing with them on a table almost. And then I built this model. And then I just peer reviewed it because I don't have the expertise at all. But I went, and that was where Claire was really clearing my path, and which enabled me to get to the head of social innovation at Stanford, and to take her advice, and to go to Singularity University, and to go to speak to Harvard, speak to MIT, speak to investors, speak to companies. And I had like a whole list of different what I called advisors. I don't think they even knew they were advisors around the world that were helping me iterate. And I walked out of meetings like thinking that I'd had it. I walked into meetings thinking I'd totally nailed it, and then walked out of meetings of crying. Nobody saw that, only me. And then just rebuilt. And it was a shameful process because I literally knew nothing, but just wanted to learn and just wanted to hear all of these people with this amazing experience and to build something that would truly reflect their experience. And the one final, which is the most important part to this puzzle, is that then when I was going through that process, I met this woman called Marcella Navarro, and we were introduced by a mutual friend, said, you absolutely have to speak. And we went to the Gaucho Grill, and I was dating a stuntman at the time, wanting to be out playing. And I was vegetarian, and they were eating big chunks of red meat. And I was like, what is this? And I met Marcella, and she'd been on her own amazing journey for the last, 2 to 3 years, or 3 years before that, where she'd been in, she'd been given the unfortunate brief within RBS to reconnect the bank to society post-crisis, and had created this amazing tool to be able to help RBS walk the walk or talk the talk. And that's, let's start investing and procuring from our local community, the local SMEs. And so she created this tool in probably one of the most risk-averse environments you could ever possibly imagine, to be able to help adopt innovations into value chains. And then she left the bank when we met at that point, and she wanted to take it to other organisations, and she took it to Cummins, which is a Fortune 500 engineering firm. So this sort of $20 billion company, and this one woman that had managed to sort of crack open this seemingly impenetrable network of Six Sigma-minded engineers to say, I know you've got this not invented here syndrome, most organisations do, but let's just try a different way and earn the trust to be able to do that. And so she was on to something massive with this. And so then I looked at what we both had together, and I was coming from an industry lens into how do we create it, but lacking that sort of execution of how does it actually work on that, on a company by company basis. And she was coming from the company going, how do I get the scale? And it's those two that join together to make the X, that's the visible X between us, where we cross paths. And we incubated it in WWF for 2 years, built the model out and put two important modules on to be able to take it from company to industry level. Yeah, peer reviewed it with about 65, 70 different organizations around the world. And then recruited two industry pilot programs, two global programs to prove that people would want it. And we're sort of in the delivery of the first one and setting up the second one as we speak.
You've taken a really deliberate approach to this. You know, it's highly analytical. You've had the support of these great organisations around you, like ADP and others. And yet there's at the heart of it a real humility, because you know, you've embarked on it by not thinking, so we have the answers here. You've embarked on it with a load of insight, but then thought, actually, well, that's not enough. And we need a heap more insight, and we need reflection, we need sense-making of this from a whole people of other people who know what they're talking about. And you've gone about it with this humility of, well, I you know, I'm happy to go into a room with someone and be shown to be wrong, or to have, you know, to expose my assumptions. I mean, is that something that innately comes easy to you, or is that something you've had to try hard at?
I think I've been the problem so many times. I look back on my life, and I've always, one thing that I've never ever had a shortage of is massive ideas. And I've been the problem. It's only really now that I recognise, looking back, because I was like, oh, I know the answer. It's this or that, and quite clearly not being in the position to be able to have the credibility or to say that. I was also born, I joke this all the time, but it's very true. I was born in the shallow end of the gene pool when it comes to gravitas, which doesn't help. I think so. This process that I've been through, there's only so many times you can be knocked back and told that you're not good enough, or that you don't know, or that before you really, really, really take it on board and you realise that you don't know. But that shouldn't preclude anyone from wanting to still want to create the change. You might not have the experience. You might not have the expertise. You might not have so many things. But if you can become, and that's what I spend my life trying to do now, is to surround myself in the shadows of giants, so that the more stupid I feel in the room, the better. Because then I know that I'm getting the right knowledge and the right expertise into it. But to try and become the almost like the, is it like a wave breaker in a way? Like I started reading, like when I started this project, I started reading a lot about, oh, it's the universe is going to look after you and it's going to be great and don't worry, just set your intentions and the rest is ruh. Then last year, because it was such a hell year of knockbacks, I then started reading about stoicism. And how one wave of the proverbial is an opportunity to get stronger, to hit the next wave of you know what, and so then I started seeing so many examples around the world of people who do create change aren't necessarily the best people in the world. They're just the people that are prepared to put their head down and really slog it out. And I think the only way you can do that, especially at the scale that we're working at, is ultimate humility. I am not here, and we are not here to save the world. We're not here to say that we know the answer. All we're here to do is recognize and pay homage to the scale of the challenge and want to play an active role in trying to make a difference. And if anyone can fault you for that, I don't think that people can. And I think that's the thing.
I love what you said about the kind of anyone gets to fix this. You know, these aren't problems that are the preserve of the few, you know, the privileged few who get the opportunity to. And yet we have, can't seem to help ourselves setting up these different programs, which are highly selective, which are winner takes all, you know, kind of incubator programs for all the brightest minds from top MBAs and so on. Why do we fall into that trap? Why do we think this is a smartest, brightest minds thing? You know, and miss the point that actually it's about those that are prepared to slog it out. Mm. You know, so the people who make breakthroughs are the ones that do the hard yards, that roll the sleeves up when no one else will, and you know, just good execution.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's a two-part question in that, because the first is why do we do it? It's the human condition. It's ego. And there's a book on my bookshelf, Ego is the Enemy, by Ryan Holiday, which is a bit ironic, really, because I think at the beginning of the book he's struggling with his ego. So there's that, a piece around why do we have all these exclusive things? Why are we constantly recreating the wheel? Why do we, when we're dealing with the world's biggest problems, why do we create silo after silo and then pretend that our silo is better than your silo? Because we're humans and we battle with our ego. And the ultimate thing we could do for this planet right now is to let go of our ego and truly collaborate, because that's where we can create change.
You must have seen that, though, with the pilots that you've been on with in different supply chains, that where, I mean, you are forcing, well, not forcing, that's the wrong word. You're enabling collaboration between giants and minnows in a lot of ways. You know, you've got emergent technologies, you've got new solutions which are coming through that have been proven, got proof of concepts, whatever, but they're just not scaling, but largely coming from SMEs. You know, small businesses. This isn't something that large businesses do naturally find particularly easy. They often see it as an expensive way of doing business. You know, the mantra is consolidating, you know, deal with the big boys in your supply chain and so on. So, you know, has it been an easy thing to encourage in others that kind of flattening the hierarchy, you know, kind of leave the how big an organization it is you work for and how many people you've got reporting for you and all that kind of thing, and just deal with each other on a level playing field and where the interest is in the idea?
So that's a really funny one that we've been getting help recently in terms of our engagement strategy, because we're going to start communicating to the world soon. And they stumbled upon this way of describing us, which I really like. They're saying that we're the neutral nexus that enables organizations of multi-stakeholder organizations within different sectors to be able to operate within the same program or same common interest, but being able to service their own self-interests at the same time. So the art, I think, of collaboration is not to expect people to come to the table and drop their egos and drop their priorities. And it's actually, how do you create the safe space within which all of the major stakeholder groups can come in and service their self-interest and not sacrifice their goals, ambitions, and all move at the same time towards a common goal. And that takes a mediator or an independent nexus. And those characters, that the nexus providers, are the ones that are few and far between. And that's where I think we help. So I don't think it's about taking people down or up on their hierarchy, or I think we'd be trying to tackle the human condition, which we don't have time for. We've got a critical time window until 2030. Some could even say 2020. So all we have to do, rather than systems change, is systems optimization. How can we help this fairly broken system to be as optimum as possible?
But it does require, I mean, aside from the ego thing, it does require people opening up and being prepared to listen to people with strong ideas who they might otherwise not pay much attention to. So that's down to your role, then, you're saying?
Well, I think again, going on the humility thing, there's a number of different ways to be able to get voices heard. We focus very specifically on being able to get the voices of sustainable innovations that really can step change large global value chains, voices heard. And we do that in a really empathetic, non-judgmental way with the companies, because they have to answer to their quarterly reporting. They've got risk criteria. They've got costs that they have to bear in mind. And so we take them through a process of translating what this brilliant idea of this innovator or these groups of innovators have, and we just translate them into the language through a sort of de-risking process that the company is ready to hear. It's a bit like me, when I mentioned earlier, sitting in those meetings and needing to be able to have the right messages sometimes, or being able to frame a conversation first so that then I can be heard. It's exactly the same with the innovators. You can't just knock on a door with a siloed report and hope that a major multinational is going to take you on because they believe in the strength of your idea. It happened, but that's a unicorn, a unicorn amongst fields of horses. And we need more than that to be able to create the change, the impact that we need to see. We need a systematic process that will enable these organisations to trust in the innovations that arrive, that they can actually deliver the job that they need and at the price that they want.
And when you think of these commodity chains, is your theory of change focused on thing? You've only got so much resource to engage so many people. So do you focus on the big players on the basis that, well, if we can get traction with them, then that'll create ripples within the rest of the sector?
Indeed, yes. So the goal of every program is to get 10% of global industry to procure alternative sustainable solutions at scale. So that 10% of industry is really important. Within the feed program that we have, that's roughly about 109 million tonnes. So by the nature of that, you do need to go for the big organisations, and as an example,
to scale the volumes quickly.
Yeah, yeah. To scale. That doesn't preclude it from rolling out, and I'll come on to that. But in order to be able to get that market pull, which is one of the fundamental principles of our model, you need to be able to get those major players. And so Nutreco or Skretting that we're working with in the food production space, they represent 35% of the industry globally for the industry segment we're working on. So it's instant. It's instant scale if you get it right with the first company. And then you systematically roll it out with the second, third, fourth, fifth to be able to reach those the overarching program goals. But yeah, and for that, there is an element of self-interest. As I said, the we can't just expect everyone to come to the table and to down their ways of doing things and the whole system that we operate in to truly collaborate. Sadly, we don't have time to be able to reconfigure the human condition. So we've created a process that gives benefits to the lead, to what we call the lead testing partner, so the lead corporation that's prepared to come on the journey with us. And then the series of benefits for the organisations that come in second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth as well. It's all based on asking, nobody in our programme does anything that they wouldn't usually do. All we do is come to the things that you do already and ask to enhance them. I think that's why we don't really get those.
What do you think you've learnt the most from this journey in terms of how to get things done?
So, good question. So I'd say communication is one of my biggest hurdles, how to simplify a message. And that links to gravitas, being able to deliver the message powerfully. Learning when it shouldn't be you delivering the message at all. So those are all linked into the communication piece. Integrity is one as well, I think. I struggled when we were going through this process of setting up an innovation within one national office, within an NGO, which is within a sector, which is in one sector of many, which is in the whole system that's creating the problem. And having to map to a very, very specific objective. And it made me wonder whether, well, obviously we're working in programs that are really high impact, but are they the biggest impact problems in the world? And so that's where our sort of 10 industries in 10 years report concept came from. It's actually taking a moment to invest heavily into the research to be able to get consensus on what are the highest impact intervention points in global value chains to be able to help bend, because it's what we're here for, bend the biodiversity and GHG curves, because everything else is fringe. And if we are going to be contributing, it's one, we need consensus at that top to define what those areas are, and two, we need to be focusing on those and nothing else. That's where we can make a difference.
Well, I think it's an object lesson to anyone who's thinking of embarking on doing anything approaching this kind of ambitious scale. How you've gone about doing it, and you know, all the while kind of carrying through this humility and this sense of you know, at ease with your own doubts, and how you've involved other people along the way. Watch this space. I think there's some exciting stuff ahead for Project X. Kate, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. And next time over a glass of wine, eh?
I think you deserve one now. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, Change Hackers.